Welcome to Leadership Beyond the Trenches. I'm your host, Anne Reifenstein, and I recently had the pleasure of interviewing Lieutenant General Mike Day. Lieutenant General Day is retired, but remains actively engaged in leadership development through his board advisory work, as well as engaging with CAF officer professional development. We talked about his views on conscious leadership, organizational culture, and the pitfalls of building a better yesterday. Here is our conversation. Welcome, Lieutenant General Day. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Absolutely. So my name is Mike Day. I'm a retired Lieutenant General from Canadian Armed Forces. I retired 5 years ago. My time in the Canadian Forces was really in three parts. I'm a Patricia from the PPCLI. I am a longtime member of the Canadian Special Forces community, and later on in my career, I spent a great deal of time at the institutional and joint level.
So you've had a very long career, and you've had, all, like you said, those three separate stages. How did your leadership evolve from those first years to the latter years?
So it's interesting, because when you sent me the questions, it really ties in quite nicely to a lot of the work that I'm doing on my own PhD work. And I think about this a lot, especially as I talk to those who have not yet made the transition out of uniform. And what that transition does, if you're interested, it allows you to sort of pause and think through what are your lessons learned. And so when you ask how leadership changes, I don't think the core tenets in hindsight actually change. What I do think changes is how you conceive of those core tenets, how you execute them, the culture, the role that you play. But increasingly, whether I look at myself, especially those moments where I failed to do things the way I would have liked in hindsight to have done them, or I look at others that have done well and that I admire, or others, quite frankly, that I don't admire. You know, there are always these main ideas, and so it has transitioned, but it's transitioned not, I guess, in basic principles, but rather the execution of basic principles.
You said you're working on a PhD right now, and that looks at these things. Do you mind sharing what that is?
Yeah. So you know, everybody has a different focus, and I always say to people when I describe this work, it interests pretty much nobody but me. You know, when you're in your late 50s doing a PhD, you're doing it not because you think you're going to move into academia, tenure track position. You do it because some things niggle at your mind. You want to do some things. And the portion that I'm looking about leadership and command at the moment is specifically about a senior leader's view of strategy and how they conceive of that. That will eventually lead to a dissertation at some stage, presumably, about this idea of strategic conversion, which was an idea written by a guy called Colin Gray, who sadly just recently passed. And it's the idea that every little thing that we do has the potential to have outsized effects, strategic effect. There are no strategic actions. There are tactical actions that lead to strategic effect. And I got interested in that because it aligns very closely to my view of leadership, in that, you know, the leaders that I've admired the most over my time in service and to this day, and the leaders that, quite frankly, I disdained the most, including up to this day, the differentiation is conscious leadership. You know, the great leaders know even the little things are important. Little things like how you walk into a room and immediately engage somebody. You know, that sets the tone for every conversation you're going to have in that next period of time. How you dismiss somebody's input because it's absolute crap is actually a leadership moment, right? How you manage somebody's input, which is thoughtful, engaging, but inappropriate to the need, that's a leadership moment. And we tend to, I think, forget that each engagement is an opportunity to be a leader. It, like, literally every single second. And I do quite a bit of public speaking and lectures to smaller groups on leadership. And this has really come down to how my thoughts on leadership have crystallized. And so a lot of my academic study, you know, focuses on that.
One of the things that I've talked about in the past is how successful institutional leadership aligns with the organizational culture, and that has to align with the strategy or the vision. And if those three things aren't in alignment, then you're not going to achieve what you want to achieve as part of that strategy. You know, using the Peter Drucker quote, you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast. So that, I don't know if that jives with your ideas on strategic effect.
It does. So I used to use that quote a lot. I think the underlying concept remains valid for me, but I think it's a necessary but insufficient expression. It doesn't go far enough for me. I would you know, say strategy without culture is failure. Culture without strategy is failure. So I think about, and I talk about this often, about the what I say to be the ABCs of leadership: activity, behavior, culture. The things that we do every second, every minute as leaders, or just as followers, by the way, and leaders doesn't mean commanders. I'll come back to this idea between the difference, in my view, at least, between command, leadership, and management, which I always I'm pedantically semantic about. But activity, behavior, culture, so the things we do every day, it becomes a normal behavior. That's what you're modeling. And when you're in a command appointment, you have an opportunity to be a leader like you do at any other stage of your career. But most particularly in a command appointment, that behavior models certain values, etc. And over time, if you have a long enough influence over your team, that becomes a culture. And so this ABC, active behavior, culture, little things continuously done becomes ingrained behavior, replicated by others becomes the culture of your organization. And if you're not, as you astutely point out, if you're not consciously driving that to align with your strategic objectives, I struggle to understand how you can actually get from, you know, A to B. You know, and if you do, by the way, and it does happen, but if you do, it's pure luck. It really is just good fortune, because conscious leadership, conscious thinking about the objectives that you've been provided, I think is what a senior institutional leader's job is all about.
Do you want to expand right now on that idea between leadership, command, and management?
Right. So it's very much like the idea when you retire at a certain rank, everybody continues to call you General, Sir, etc. And I say to them, you know, that's great, but I in the Special Forces Committee, that doesn't happen, by the way. Just, you know, it's a much more, not relaxed, but a much more personal relationship, which obviously one I enjoy and favor. But the command, like senior rank, is essentially the legal authority to be able to tell people what to do, to direct resources to be allocated in a certain way. That's what command is. You can be a great commander or a bad commander. That means the quality of your decision-making. I've seen some great commanders who have made great decisions, but they've been at best mediocre leaders. They're never bad leaders, because great commanders can't be bad leaders. I've seen some horrible commanders. They're just Peter Principle. They've outstripped their capacity, but they're inspirational. And you would often say, God, I wish that individual was less inspirational, because he's inspiring his team to do absolute crap work, right? It's misdirected in other cases. So command is this authority piece. Management, and I separate this out, and it's a nuance, but I think it is important, at least for my construct, to understand. Management really is about allocation of resources, right? You know, the idea that you've got some physical things, you know, the management of a road convoy. That's just pure planning. It's time past point. You've got X number of vehicles. You've got a piece of road. You know, you got to go from A to B, et cetera. That's good management. You've got an annual budget, right? You have to sit down and you have to allocate them in chunks, etc. You've got X number of rounds of ammunition. Like you and I, you know, throughout our careers can cite lots of examples of pure managerial type activities. I don't mean to diminish them. They're essential. They're, you know, militaries run on good management. But then there's leadership. And I am a traditionalist in that I think about leadership as being the ability to inspire people to do things that you want them to do. So, and they want to do it after you've inspired them. And leadership is not associated with rank and or appointment. It's an influence activity. And so when I talk about command, vice management, vice leadership, I think each of them for senior appointments are essential to be effective. But I do differentiate between each, actually to a pretty significant degree.
You know, earlier you spoke about how the leadership or the relationship in SOFCOM was different. Could you just expand on, or just talk a little bit about your time as the commander of SOFCOM, particularly because you took SOFCOM from, you know, unit and then grew, you were in the guy who grew it into what we recognize it as today, it's CAN SOFCOM.
Right. So I would say two things very quickly to preface, to set the sort of the context. One, none of my conversation about CANSOFT is meant to diminish any of my other experiences, my other affiliations. You know, I'm a proud patrician. You know, I run the Patricia Charity, the foundation. You know, my lifelong friends, the compatriots, you know, a great deal of them come from my regiment. I'm proud of my roots. And in my initial years, I think what allowed me to be initially successful going through selection for CANSOFT was actually based on my first 8 years in the regiment. You know, my ability to come back and command a battalion and deploy with them and survive and hopefully do reasonably well in that appointment was based on the regimental preparation I had. The other thing I would say to you is, I was in CANSOFT at a series of pivotal stages, right? It is a gross exaggeration to say that I'm responsible for what it is today. It is, and you have to serve in CANSOFT to appreciate. Like I love the Hillary Clinton analogy. It takes a village, right? As long as it's not a village of idiots, you're good to go. In CANSOFT, I joined literally on week one. You know, we had six people in JTF2 when I joined, and it was an absolute voyage of discovery. I didn't join an operational troop for a year. There were guys, quite frankly, who did better on selection than I did, and who got a chance to command troops before I did. For me, that was great because it allowed me to better understand what we were trying to do from, you know, without facing the pressure that those first troop commanders faced. I commanded task forces for CANSOFT. I went back to command the unit and I commanded the command. But I'm one of, and I could give you, you know, the two dozen names without which any one of those, we probably would not be where we are today, right? And so, you know, this is not false humility. This is awareness, understanding of the journey that it took. So I see that as a preface comment. But why is CANSOFT differently? Because for the first time in generations, Canada has created a new capability from scratch. It absolutely nothing. Done under extraordinary circumstances, under Rick Hillier's leadership. At a time when, you know, we didn't have anything to start with, pressure from the Army, quite frankly, to be more Army-centric or to be absorbed by the Army. But the great thing about standing up with the Special Forces community was we all knew the same amount about Special Forces, which was jack shit, right? We all started at the same level. And so although, you know, you have this organization, quite small to begin with, our first year and a half, we were 115 people for the first couple of years, right? And so what you had to do, if you were going to get from A to B, and our A to B was, we had 1 year to recruit, select, train, and be ready to be operational 1 year later, because we became operational on the 1st of April, 1993. We sort of started on the 1st of April, 1992, for all intents and purposes. And so you couldn't follow the classic pyramidal, I'm going to do my estimate, conceive of this, et cetera, and drive it forward, which is a sequential, and works great for armies, a sequential capability development map. You had to work on about seven or eight lines of operations, all moving concurrently, empowering relatively junior leaders to do certain things, because quite frankly, the rest of the leadership, four or five officers, quite frankly, were super busy doing other things. And so what that did was it set the tone very early on, not for the banishment of rank, not for the ignoring of appointments and everything else. The chain of command was the chain of command. But what it did was it created the culture where subject matter experts truly were entrusted in leading and managing the development of discrete bits of our capability set. And so right from word one, individuals were empowered and entrusted with an authority that quite frankly they would not have received in convention and shouldn't have received, because, you know, if you're a master corporal or a sergeant in an infantry battalion or a lieutenant or a captain, you're working for people who have decades of experience, who have done all of the jobs that you have done, who have done them to a sufficiently excellent level where they get promoted and trusted more. Their experience set, their training, their education, their self-development, the whole ecosystem is mature. It continues to develop, but it's mature. The start point from CANSOF was kind of like starting, you know, army units 500 years ago, right? Where, you know, so it's, that is what became different. And what it allowed us to do is to continue to some degree that empowerment. Now, things have changed. You know, JPF2 has just finished its officer selection literally 2 days ago. It does its annual thing, et cetera. When I went through selection, I was 31 years old, right? You know, the so 3 years ago, apparently. But this year, the average age for officers going through selection was about 25 years old. And their young captains are about to be promoted, as opposed to, I was in the equivalent of an AOC. We didn't call it AOC back then, but an AOC captain. And I was the most junior of the captains who qualified through selection, because we recognized at the front end there was no supporting infrastructure. We didn't have squadron commanders or COs who were qualified, et cetera. Everybody was older. Now, when a young troop commander comes to JTF2, his troop warrant has 10 years or more in that unit. His squadron 2IC has done all his jobs. His squadron commander, you know, is a highly experienced, multiple deployments, like half a dozen deployments, has done domestic cycles. So we've evolved, but critically, we've kept this core idea that we can farm out areas of expertise to relatively junior individuals. So we send regularly in the community at large in CANSOFCOM, we'll send small detachments out around the world, you know, led by a variety of ranks that's mission specific as opposed to rank specific, right? And I think that's the big difference that you see. That doesn't mean you need less leadership. Quite frankly, dealing with a whole squadron, a whole unit of AAA personalities is super easy and super hard, right? You know, the best people in a battalion are as good or better than the best people in JTF2. No ands, if, or buts. The difference in JTF2 is everybody is carefully selected for fit for purpose and has a drive that you don't see universally across a line unit in a conventional unit. So the quality piece is squashed, if you will, in places like CSOR, JTF2, 427, CGIRU, where if you become an administrative burden, we don't manage you, we post you. It's a massive luxury. But what you get on the other side of that coin is everybody thinks they know it better, you know? Here's a war story. I'll try to tell a few war stories, but here's a great war story. So I had taken over my troop after 1 year. I passed Sexum, but I was employed as the Adj for my first year. I'd been a previous Adj, that's probably why, because they thought, you can't screw this up twice, you've learned, you know? I took over from a guy called Phil Tyrell, and Phil's been out for years and years, but Phil is a tactical, just a savant. Like he was just excellent at those sorts of things. So huge pressure falling, you know, very big boots. We're doing our first domestic train exercise, and it was an aircraft drill, et cetera. And I'm briefing orders. You always briefed orders in plenary. Everybody sits on orders, right? It's like patrol orders. Everything you do. So everybody's in the same OODA loop, et cetera. So I give my orders, and one of the deck commanders stands up and goes, that was brutal, he said. Here's what we missed. So we had a conversation about that and everything else, but it's a great reminder to a troop commander, which is, you know, you're not going to get the warrant pulling you aside quietly afterwards going, hey, sir, you got to pay attention to the fog, bang, bang, bang. You're going to get some trooper who will stand up and go, you kind of suck. And we deserve better, and you're going to do better, et cetera. You know, and it's never personalized. And if you take it personally, you never survive it. But those are the leaders. It's the operating dynamic environment that is just so different.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I get that. And that feeds into the organizational culture that was established, you know, and so how did you shape that when the organization started to get bigger?
It did. And look, that shaping goes on to today. There's not only the operational requirement to align culture with objectives and strategy, but there's also, quite frankly, the big elephant in the room, as there always is in the special operations, especially tier one unit, which is how do you avoid the downsides of elitism, right? How do you have a culture that truly focuses on service and humility and all those other things, but run a selection process that, quite frankly, is designed to identify individuals fit for purpose who are exceptional in their domain? Doesn't mean they're exceptional to everything else. For example, you would not want a JTF2 operator flying an F-18 or driving a submarine. You know, some of them could not, you know, participate in an infantry battalion because they, you know, they could be an airframe tech, for God's sakes. But they do have some exceptional capabilities. So when you say, how do you continue to evolve it? You actually have to pay attention to both things. You have to evolve a culture that focuses on strategic objectives, and you have to focus a culture that really, really has an overt recognition that there are some big potential downsides if you're not paying attention to them. And look, we see this in the press today. We've got to be very open about this. I look at what the Australian SAS is going through. I look at what some of the SEAL teams down south have gone through, etc. It's a challenge. So my answer to that, because context is always important for these things for me, my answer to that it has always been, you know, constant personal engagement at the individual and collective level is the only way you move culture. Back to my ABCs, right? Literally every single thing you do. Now, with that organization, like CANSOFCOM, because you're selecting what we like to refer to as cognitive warriors, people who need to intellectually process what they're doing, right? Otherwise, they turn off. They, you know, everybody thinks that this is abundant selection is about physical fitness. Like, you can make anybody fitter, right? You just need to beast them and own their lives, and you can do that. That's not actually what we select for, right? Yes, we use physical fitness as a prerequisite, but quite frankly, once we've beaten you up physically to induce stress, all of selection is about mental processes. All of selection is about mental processes. Do you operate under stress? And so when you deal with culture, if that's what you're selecting for, you have to accept that the thing they're going to respond to is intellectual engagement. So for me, it was always, and it remains always, by the way, in any of my engagement with Kansan, it's always about, why do we exist, right? What is our role? How do you contribute to our role? And we exist to serve a series of national objectives. And you need to internalize that we are no better or worse. And the national objectives that we serve, how we serve them, are unique. But by the way, before you start to feel super special, so does NORAD, right? Right? So does the logistics chain that ensures that every operation that we deploy to around the world remains effective. So, yes, we do something that few people can do. But there are a whole bunch of people in the Canadian Armed Forces do things that other people can't do or don't want to do or aren't inspired to do, etc. So this is that balance in between, here's our objectives, here's why we are uniquely privileged to serve that. By the way, there are other things that people do, and they're uniquely privileged and able to do that, right? And so it's that constant, you know, push-pull, if you will. It's much like leadership and operational stress, right? It's that same push-pull that you always have to sort of keep people engaged and aware of the upside and the downside of sort of how you manage that space. That to me has always been the key to evolving the, what we would call the gray man culture of CANSOFCOM, right?
I read your 2017 article actually, where you talked about capability development and talked about how we're just building on new stuff of what we've already got, new old stuff, as opposed to new stuff. So is that, you know, because that's a large part of what institutional leaders do is their part of their mandate actually is to build the requisite capability. How do we shape the organizational culture that will support risk-taking on future capabilities?
Right. So, the phrase I use, I shamelessly borrow it, normally without attribution, but since I'm in the public domain here, I'll attribute it to John Newton, a retired two-star out on the East Coast. John once used a conversation with me, not formally, but in a conversation, there may have been beers involved. He said, building a better yesterday. And my concern is, that's what we've done. We've built a better yesterday. And so I use that phrase quite a bit, although I suspect I'm using it in a way that John had not intended. So any criticism of that should come my way, not John's way. But, you know, my experience and by appointment in force development, capability development world really happened in four separate area times. I was an EA to a position called DGSP, Director General Strategic Plans, essentially the force developer for the Canadian Forces. You know, later on in my career became the CEO of JTF2, where we didn't really have a command. We had one, but it was just starting up. So I was still responsible for the capability development of the unit. Became Commander CANSOFCOM, where we were just exploding in capability development. And then became the Chief Strategic Planner for Canadian Forces, the CFD, where I had to lead the capability piece. And there's a thread throughout all of that, as I look back, you know, about the importance of intellectual process, how we get hidebound by project process, two different things, how we continue to perpetuate success which is quite frankly the law of diminishing returns, but because we continue to build more of what we were excellent at, etc. And so this idea will require, in my view, another Hillier-like maneuver. And people will say a lot of good and bad things about Rick Hillier. Probably all of them are deserved. I'm a Hillier boy in that a great deal of my command time was spent under Rick Hillier. I worked for him a couple of times, etc. The system can only take a Hillier-like shock on a generational basis because it takes time for a big institution to absorb that, internalize that, etc. You know, what are his lasting legacies? His lasting legacies really are what became CJOC from CEFCOM, Canada Command, CANOSCOM, and CANSOFCOM, and a strategic joint staff. You know, that's massive change, although people don't credit it as capabilities because it isn't platforms. We mistake platforms for capabilities, by the way. I'll come back to that. But I do believe we are at an inflection point, or we should be at an inflection point, where as we refresh at some stage SSE, we need to reconceive of what Canada's role in the world is. And there's sort of two thoughts I want to add to that then. First of all, capabilities are not platforms. Canada's bought a new capability in the future fighter. No, it hasn't. Capabilities are an amalgam of four things: physical equipment, the people in using that, the training that those people go through, and the supporting infrastructures required to keep that whole piece working. And that's a multiplication table. If one of those values is zero, you have no capability. Zero. So you can have a plane and a pilot, but if you don't train them, doesn't matter how good your base is. Or you can have a great base, a great pilot, a great training system. But if your plane sucks, you're not going to have a capability. And you can use that analogy where you zero out one of those four elements. So I think, you know, we've got to think about sort of capability in that regard, right? We just always got to remind ourselves that that's what we do. The second piece we need to remind ourselves is we claim a need for certain capabilities. I've always questioned that planning assumption. Canada's expeditionary operations, bar none, are discretionary. We get to decide what we do, where we do it, with who, for how long, under what rules, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Essentially, the world gets to consume whatever Canada decides to offer. And the way it works in reality inside the Canadian system is the government chooses from options that the military develops and provides. We decide the capabilities. So the assessment, we need a general combat capability writ large. I question that because I question, what do you mean by general? What do you mean by combat? When do you mean capability? There are certain things we need to do for defense of Canada, defense of North America, we are compelled to do. No arguments there, right? And we quite frankly give short shrift to the fundamentally changing environmental situation we find ourselves in based on climate change, which is the greatest security threat to Canada, bar none. And we ignore our Arctic to our detriment, not this year. But it'll take us 20 or 30 years to develop a true Arctic capability, and we haven't really started. We give it lip service because we'd rather deploy naval task groups to be embedded in U.S. strike carrier groups, and we'd rather deploy, you know, fighter six packs, you know, to do cool, fancy things over Europe, and we'd rather deploy brigades to fight and special forces, you know, task forces to do cool, sexy things, etc. That's all discretionary. And so my challenge to the capability developers of the Canadian Forces, the senior appointments of the Canadian Forces is, we have a window of time where we can make that crazy Ivan shift, that hard 90 degree shift from Red October. I love that phrase.
Yeah.
We've got a period of time where we can do that. and we can still be where we need to be in time. I worry about the length of time it takes us to do things and the time available, but that window of adjustment is it's fast closing. I don't pretend it will ever be irrelevant, right? We produce world-class capabilities. I just think that those world-class capabilities will be less fungible to achieve national strategic objectives.
I want to just talk about organizational change. One of the things they talk about, you know, the transformational leader is the one who's kickstarting the organizational change. And you do it through communication of vision and intent, and then you resource people. And what traits do we look for in leaders who, so they can do these crazy Ivan turns, so they can take a look at, okay, this is a complete left turn, but this is where we got to go.
Having just extolled the virtues of that individual who will do a crazy Ivan, I should be more specific. It's generational change. I do not believe that military such as Canada can afford, let alone enact, transformational change. What I think we can do is dial up in the short term. What I think we can do is dial up the pace of evolutionary change so that over multiple generations, let's say three planning cycles, 20 years, we can have a transformation. But when I think about transformation, I actually think about generational transformation, not in-year transformation. In-year transformation requires such a breaking of the system that all you will essentially do is break the system. So although I believe we need to transform and we need leaders who have that transformational vision and they drive the institution towards a transformational vision, I think it is not only impossible, I think it is foolhardy to try to do that in a single mandate. So the transformational qualities, to get to your question then, that I look for are people who have transformational vision, transformational assessment of the view of the role that Canada can play, and strategic patience, endurance, and resilience to get us there incrementally, step by step, and develop the subsequent leaders who will continue with that strategic patience, but have that transformational vision. You cannot turn the Canadian Armed Forces on the dime. We shouldn't want to. We have ongoing mandates. We have things we need to do every year. What we need is this transformational vision for the complete Canadian Armed Forces, and then enact a plan that drives us towards that, that has a refresh and an assessment of two things: where that objective is on the horizon, and it will always be adjusted a little bit, but where we are on the success path and what we would prioritize to continue to keep rapid evolution in train.
That sounds a lot like the role of being a steward, looking for someone to steward the organization. So I know that sounds very passive, but that building of the next generation of leaders, right? That's fundamental to stewarding the profession of arms.
It is. Look, on the general officer scroll that you receive when you get promoted, they actually talk about this being a steward of the institution. It's there in black and white. The challenge, as it always is with the use of language, is semantics. Some, I worry, will not see this interpretation of stewardship that you've articulated, which resonates with me as a definition, but doesn't resonate with me of matching the term. The steward of the institution seems to me to imply a status quo, right? I like your interpretation better than mine. But I fear that most institutional leaders would adhere to my view of being the steward, vice yours. So I don't minimize for a moment the requirement to shepherd and to protect the institution and to preserve all of the goodness that is within that institution. Absolutely. And that needs stewardship in the pejorative way that I'm talking about, which is you need to not break the machine in a way and that it can't continue to function. Because as you continue to evolve, you actually need to continue to produce, right? And this is why I believe that strategic patience gets after this piece. And so you're right. So you have, you really have, you have four or five lines of operation as an institutional leader in this construct that we're talking about. You need to not just articulate a strategic horizontal vision, right, that everybody buys into. You need to develop a path that gets you there in macro chunks with granularity in the first couple of years and successive less granularity as you go forward. You need to, and that's, by the way, those having a vision in and of itself does not get you, you know, to Jesus, right? You need, you know, those are two different strategies. The strategy to develop a vision and the strategy to execute, create and execute a plan. Then you need to have a development of leaders, because our CDSs never last long enough. Even John Vance, who has been there since Christ was a corporal, they're never there long enough to execute a 30-year plan. So you need to make sure that successive leaders are committed to the construct that you've created. They've bought in, and you need to develop them accordingly. And then you need to work on the culture where constant change is not seen as being disruptive. Because we hear, you've heard, I've heard our whole careers, if we could just stop for a second and stabilize things, we'd be okay. That, like, that's the death knell of professionalism. Constant evolution must be embraced as a cultural component. Back to, if we're the same as we were 5 years ago, we're broken and wrong. Right? And then you need to have this system that inculcates all of that into a coherent piece. That's when we're talking about the necessary skill sets, the competencies, the qualities of our institutional leaders. That's what I would want to see.
I'm just going to take you back to a comment that you said earlier about being one of Hillier's boys. So what prepared you for being an institutional leader in the CAF? Was it role models like General Hillier? Was it professional development? Was it experience? Was it the education? Is there anything that stands out in your mind in terms of what got you ready to do that job?
So I'm just finishing a paper. I hope I press send on it tomorrow, about the main influences on general officers' perspectives on strategy, how they define strategy, how they think of the strategic role of a general officer, and what has been their greatest educational and experiential influences that have allowed them to come to those first two conclusions. And so I this is just absolutely my wheelhouse. And so in order to develop this construct, I had to sort of look at myself, etc. You know, we don't come to the military as babes in the woods. We're not fully formed functioning human beings. I've had, you know, I said two sons go through the military college system and phase training and everything else. And so I've had, and they're separated enough by years. I had sort of 7 or 8 years of being in auto, being the flop house of drunken RMC cadets. And so I'm as aware as anybody that they're this conundrum of, you know, thoughtful, hardworking, et cetera, young, you know, men and women. And they come with their own ideas and own ideologies, but yet they're still absolutely embryonic in terms of leaders. So that reminds me that there are actually a series of influences that exerted themselves on me before I joined that actually have had a pretty significant influence on my lens. You know, my father being first and foremost, my childhood, my growing up in an English boarding school had a tremendous influence on how I think about it. And then the first couple of leaders in the regiment, the Patricias, and I can point to a couple of them. And then, quite frankly, going through selection and working with this group of, quite frankly, utterly different individuals that I've been exposed to in mass in JTF2. And then my last really formative piece before things started to crystallize was my time as an EA to a two-star in the force development world. So I actually have combined those points. And then I've looked at those individuals And really it comes down to, you know, I hate to say it, two groups, two macro groups, two individuals, two groups of individuals. One who has said is, although there is no perfect leader that I've ever worked for, there is no such thing. There are attributes of individuals that I say, I really admire that. In my career, I'm going to aspire to exhibit that. And equally, there are individuals who I have worked for, I've said is, whatever I do later on in my career, I will absolutely not do the following things that they've done. And so, although education has played a huge role in sort of my career development, my personal development, really it is the role modeling of individuals for whom I've worked that has had the greatest influence on my vision of what it takes to be successful, right? And to this day, you know, I can cite by name and specific examples and discussions of that 10 individuals of both groups, five and five or half a dozen, you know, that inspire me to this day, right? I can give you chapter and verse. They've been so influential that I can actually describe the settings, you know, they're just so live. Thereafter, and that formative piece kind of stopped for me at around at the rank of major. It didn't mean I didn't keep on learning. But in hindsight, as I look back, what the learning did thereafter was crystallize the lessons I learned in my first 15 years or so. So it was the crystallization, the hardening of values and ideas that were predicated on these examples.
So what was the most satisfying part of being a leader for you?
Or what is the most satisfying part of being a leader for you?
So I left early. I didn't do my full 35, et cetera. And I say to people, I have no regrets about the time and circumstance. I left a happy, content, blessed individual, tremendously grateful for the experiences, et cetera. I'm not, and I say that because I'm actually not sure that I can answer that question well. As a leader, I can answer that question, what made me happiest about my time in uniform. And it will come across as utterly trite, but no less, in, you know, no less meaningful to me, which is, you know, if you're lucky, if in life, you find a profession where you are just comfortable and you work with people who you relate to and who you can admire. And so the thing I've enjoyed most about it is to work with people who not only do I just like, not all of them, right? Like, there's some real dickheads in the Canadian Armed Forces, but there are in every profession, right? You know, my dad used to tell me that. He says, you know, there are dreamers, there are sons of bitches, there are doers, etc. Be realistic. But what I enjoyed most was, you know, having those moments, whether it be a subordinate, a peer, or a superior, you know, where I sat back later on and go, that was remarkable. Like, that was just utterly remarkable what that individual just did. And it just, it has, since then, it's just filled me with such a feeling of satisfaction and of happiness that, compared to so many people I've met in my life, I'm genetically a happy person. I'm predisposed to being happy. I'm predisposed, I think, to be treating people well, although it's one side of a leadership technique that I always advise people to follow. It's an idea that I always have in my mind. But this sheer joy of being a member of the Canadian Armed Forces is, I just got lucky, right? And you know, it was being a part of that TNF family, by the way, that continues to this day. I've been out 5 years. that joy continues to this day, right? I am just one of those blessed individuals who found their calling.
Yeah, it doesn't get much better than that. And then particularly if it allows you to continue to serve, right? Either in uniform or not in uniform, but if you continue to represent the Canadian Armed Forces, you know, working to make it better, caring about the institution itself, you know, you don't just wipe your hands and walk away and go, okay, I'm done.
Yeah, so I think this is something that retired people, not all retired people, actually internalize, which is whether you're doing something consciously, back to my view of leadership, every moment is an opportunity. Whether we like the idea, whether we embrace it or we don't embrace it, here's the reality, which is we are modeling the general public's perception of what the Canadian Armed Forces are, whether we're serving or retired. So I know as a retired three-star, but it wouldn't matter because it's the same for my sons, by the way. One left early as an officer cadet, one left as a captain. I know when, because they're both tremendous, and they should be, they do both did super well in phase training and RMC, et cetera. You know, when people look at me, they go, oh, that's what a general officer in the Canadian Armed Forces is like. When they look at my sons, that's what a junior officer, you know, second lieutenant or captain, they got at those ranks. That's what those are. And so whether we consciously accept, whether we like, whether we disagree, the fact is Joe and Jane Public are assessing the Canadian Armed Forces based on their interactions with people like you and me, as well as those serving. You cannot escape that. And so we do continue to serve. My question always is to individuals, which is, are you serving with honor and respect? Are you adding to the institution? Are you adding to that place that made you who you are? Are you diminishing it? Because what you say and do is going to have one of those two effects.
So I'd just like to take the time to thank you very much for sharing your ideas with me. There's a lot of stuff in there. There's a multitude of things to process and unpack and really maybe drill down into. I'm quite interested actually in following up on some of your ideas on organizational culture and the leadership, transformational leadership in that incremental change. So thanks very much. I really appreciate you doing this with me.
Delighted to. It was great.
So that was that wraps up our conversation with Lieutenant General Mike Day. It was a great experience to talk with him. He has such a lot of really good, well-developed ideas that really make you think about, how can we do this better? And really inspires you to do better. I hope you enjoyed this chat, and I hope you'll join us again on Leadership Beyond the Trenches. Leadership Beyond the Trenches is hosted and produced by Anne Reifenstein. Theme music is provided by Mikhail Heilman under Creative Commons licensing.